Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Julie Goodwin. Coming up in the next hour, WFPL's Stephanie Sanders talks with three more members of Louisville's Metro Council.
Sometimes news can take on the wrong kind of image. As far as I'm concerned, there's not one person on the council that if I feel like I want to talk to them, that their doors are not open.
Also, WFPL's Rick Hallett talks about traveling to the Middle East with three men who made the trip earlier this year.
And I found out how much our communities are not aware of each other. And there is a big barrier. And that barrier is based on misunderstanding.
And we'll start our series called A Day in the Life with Belle of Louisville captain Mark Doty.
Back and slow. He can't see what's going on, so I'm his eyes out here.
Watch here.
Now, the news. Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Julie Goodwin. Coming up in a few minutes, WFPL's Rick Hallett interviews three men who traveled to the Middle East earlier this year with a Louisville organization. First, we continue our series of interviews with members of Louisville's Metro Council. This week, we'll hear from the representatives from Districts 19, 20, and 21. WFPL's Stephanie Sanders spoke with District 19 Councilman Hal Heiner about party politics in city government.
Do you think that the council as it is now, maybe not in the beginning, but as it is now, do you think the council is polarized?
Today I feel the council is less polarized than it was in the beginning. Well, maybe the first couple months it wasn't too polarized, but by the end of that first year it became very partisan, had sort of organized into two camps. But as this government has matured, both sides have realized that by not working together, we're not getting the best legislation. That isn't to say that there aren't still some partisan votes, but it's a lot less prevalent today than it was 4 years ago when this council started.
It would probably seem, though, to people who maybe don't watch on Metro TV or something like that, maybe if they just look at the voting, it might seem that it is still polarized, especially on maybe some of the bigger, more controversial things that the council has dealt with. Do you think that it's accurate when it comes down to the big votes that it is still polarized?
Well, a lot of times the disagreement is more about procedure than the actual issue at hand. And recently, on some of the recent legislation, the concern about an inadequate time for debate, an inadequate time to hear the citizens' thoughts and comments, and really coming up with thoughtful legislation has been more the focus of the partisan voting than a disagreement that something needed to be done about an issue. But there really has not been a shortage of debate on this council, which is, in the end, is a good thing.
Who do you think the most powerful or maybe the most persuasive person on the council is?
You know, this has been an interesting 4 years on the council. In business, if you're in management, a lot of times you see a problem and then the next day you work to fix it. And in this government with 26 equal members, you see a problem in government, and then the next challenge is to find 13 other people, so you have a majority that agree that a problem exists, and then work to a solution. Because the 26 members are equal, other than leadership on particular committees, I don't really see anyone having emerged as particularly powerful on the council. Certainly the committee chairs have more influence on items in front of their committee than other members of that committee. And we have, I think, 11 different committees and committee chairs. But I'd say the influence on the council is pretty widespread.
Stephanie Sanders also spoke with District 20 Councilman Stuart Benson, who says his office spends a lot of time keeping up communication with residents of his district.
And so when we first got in office, one of the things we thought that a lot of people thought that everybody was complaining. And it's not when a person calls you, and we call it issues and concerns. There's no complaints. If they disagree with you, that's okay, because they could be right. They're more than likely, they probably are right.
Do you agree with me in thinking that maybe not enough people know what Metro Council is, or even who their Metro Council representative is?
Absolutely. One of the things I do, I try to wear my name tag wherever I go, just to make sure. There's some people, or maybe could be a little arrogant, think that they're really somebody important. Everybody's important. I'm not more important than anybody else, but I do serve, and so they need to know who the person is. It represents them. Like I said, the email newsletter, I'm working hard this year. I'm going to try to get more and more people on our email newsletter, because there's a lot of people who do card mailings every quarter. Sometimes that's too late, and it costs a lot. So if you could let everybody know every week what's happening in their district or in the community, where they can be responsive to tell you how they feel. So I appreciate it.
Do you think that the council, as it is now, is polarized?
Not necessarily. Sometimes news can take on the wrong kind of image. There's, as far as I'm concerned, there's not one person on the council that if I feel like I want to talk to them, that their doors are not open. I have good dialogue. Do I expect all of them to believe exactly like me? No. I've got five daughters. In our house, I usually lose, but not in a bad way, in a positive way. When we discuss an issue, and that's what you want. You want good discussion. Let's make sure that we think this thing through. And there's been a couple times we've done just the opposite of that. There's been a couple power struggles. And when that happens, we learn quick. And we see that the people are really upset, and they should be. And the way to handle that sometimes is at the ballot box, because government's too precious. Everybody should be there to do the very best and to serve. And there's people who will say, I voted for you because I think you're a nice person. That's complimentary. But I really like to think people vote for me because I'm doing a good job. And they should vote me out if I'm not doing a good job. That's important.
So you think as it sits right now, Metro Council is working properly and doing its best and maybe learning with maybe even each meeting how to operate more smoothly?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so my message would be to people that get involved with your district or your council person, and you will be surprised that the cooperation and the insight, the people really, they've never had this kind of representation before. And people are really kind of amazed. And so more and more people who would get involved, it's going to make our community such a better place.
District 21 Councilman Dan Johnson has served on Metro Council since its inception and was on the Board of Aldermen before that. He spoke with Stephanie about how he entered city government.
To help the people. There were things that weren't done. I live on Kimwood Hill, and sometimes the snow wasn't even being removed during the wintertime, and we have seen to it that that's been done since I've been there.
Do you feel, whether in your district specifically or throughout Metro Louisville, do you feel that most people know what Metro Council is and what goes on in this building?
Most people know who I am in my district because I've been there for a long time, but and they know what I do.
What about the rest of the council?
I'm not sure as it carries forward across districts.
So I assume... when you're saying that most people in your district know who you are, it's because of kind of outreach things that your office has done?
This is my 16th year in office. I've won 7 elections as either alderman or councilman. Therefore, they know me. And I've been, we've done numerous mailings to the districts telling them what's going on. I wrote the first law for merging government. I was the originator of the idea for the downtown arena. I helped solve the basement bank backflow problem that we were having, and I put in something to the tune of 15 miles of sidewalks in my neighborhood. I've paved nearly every street in the 21st district at least once, and some of them 2 or 3 times. They know what I do.
What about maybe not so much Dan Johnson, but the council as a whole? Do you think Louisvillians have an accurate picture of how the council works?
I don't know. Some people are just downright mad at the council because of things we do, but as a whole, I think most people are fairly supportive of, you know, with the laws we've been having to redo because of the sunset. Many of us have had emails and letters on different things that have happened, and I think that there's a lot of concern over some issues, and but then again, yeah, they know when there's a smoking ban, they know when there's a dog ordinance, they know when, you know, things like that happen and what that's about, and I think they're aware.
Do you feel like in those cases that you mentioned, do you think that maybe people get the impression that the council is partisan or polarized?
Actually, I'm not sure that's the case, because I think the smoking ordinance was nearly unanimous. The dog ordinance was made to be partisan because of some people were trying to put party in it and say, we're the good guys, we're trying to keep this ordinance from being so restrictive. But I think that what's happening now is everybody's working on the dog ordinance to fix what they might have messed up on the first go around. They're trying to do it again, and I think it'll get better.
Okay, so you see Metro Council as maybe not being perfect, but certainly working towards that, toward being more effective?
Yes.
The complete versions of these interviews, as well as an archive of previously aired interviews, are available at our website. Go to WFPL.org. From there, you can also view a map of Louisville Metro according to Metro Council districts. Learn more about each representative and find out who represents your district. Churchill Weavers of Berea, Kentucky may be out of business, but the history of the world-famous textile manufacturer will live on through a museum exhibit in Frankfort. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh has the story.
In 1948, at the height of its success, Churchill Weavers of Berea grossed $500,000 in sales and employed 150 workers, mostly women. Founded in 1922 by Carol and Eleanor Churchill, the manufacturer of high-quality textiles not only produced hand-woven baby blankets, throws, clothing, and commissioned art pieces, but also the linings for NASA's first space suits. Lila and Richard Belando purchased the company in 1973 and ran it until 1996, when it was sold to Crown Crafts. Lila Belando remained on as manager.
It was never a company that made a lot of money, but when we were competing with all the competition, we started to lose money, significant amount of money, to the point that Crown said, we're going to close you.
After 85 years in business, Crown closed Churchill Weavers and sold the name, intellectual property, website, yarn inventory, looms, and other equipment to Walcott Weavers of Indiana. But Lila Belando bought the company's archives, which included 300,000 pieces of fabric, 100,000 documents, advertising signs, hundreds of photos and tools, and personal effects of the owners. Anxious to see it all preserved, she sold the entire collection to the Kentucky Historical Society, which received a generous donation from Louisville philanthropist Joan Crawley Day. Belando couldn't be more pleased.
Can you imagine if somebody acquired this who didn't know what they had? It would probably just all be thrown out, or it would sit in several basements and rot.
She says it's a phenomenal collection.
I think the earliest piece of fabric is 1924, but we can go back and find examples of what was done, who they were done for, even who wove them sometimes, how much they cost, because all the records are there.
Marilyn Zotis of the Kentucky Historical Society is in charge of cataloging and preparing the collection for display. She plans to let museum visitors watch the work.
When I was at the Smithsonian, we collected Julia Child's kitchen, and that collection was so big, we didn't have a place to store it or process it. So what we did was do it behind a glass wall so people could watch it. So I'm going to take that model and implement that here.
Zotis is excited about the chance to help preserve an important piece of Kentucky history. She says Churchill Weaver's products are woven into the fabric of 20th century American social history.
When Carol Churchill developed this company, not only could he employ local workers, most of whom were women, but also develop a fine quality product to develop Kentucky's reputation so that Kentucky could be known for fine handcrafts in an artisanal tradition.
His wife, Eleanor, who had an innate flair for textile design, marketing, and promotion, was also key to the company's success. Lila Belando says the Churchills were a fascinating couple, and there are many stories to tell. For instance, did you know that Carol Churchill was an MIT-educated engineer who developed retractable landing gear for airplanes?
He was interviewed by Thomas Edison and offered a job with Mr. Edison. They did an interview on the train. When the train stopped and he got off, he said he would not work for Thomas Edison because he was just much too arrogant.
Carol and Eleanor Churchill, who both lived into their 90s, are buried in Oberlin, Ohio. The exhibit of their lives and the company they founded, Churchill Weavers, will go on display in May 2008 at the Kentucky History Museum. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
When we come back, WFPL's Rick Hallett talks with three men who traveled to the Middle East in search of answers to some of the oldest questions about the conflict there. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Julie Goodwin. Coming up a little later in the show, we'll kick off our new series called A Day in the Life. For our first installment, WFPL's Stephanie Sanders spent the day with Belle of Louisville captain Mark Doty. First, in mid-February of this year, four Louisville residents set out for the Middle East to get a first-hand look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The four men affiliated with the Louisville group Interfaith Paths to Peace spent 14 days in the region where they visited Jerusalem, the West Bank, Jordan, and other places. Three of them joined us recently to discuss their trip. Bashar Masri is an American citizen of Palestinian descent, born and raised in the West Bank. Mark Isaacs is a Jewish American who once lived and studied in Israel. And Terry Taylor is a Quaker who's director of Interfaith Paths to Peace. They spoke with WFPL's Rick Hallett.
Well, gentlemen, let's start with the trip itself. Why did you decide to go, and exactly where did you go?
Well, Interfaith Paths to Peace worked with our two board members, Mark Isaacs and Bashar Masri, who had brought a wonderful group of high school age students here in 2004 to do performances here in the Louisville area, kids from Nablus in the West Bank and from Nazareth in Israel. And as a kind of follow-up to that, we decided to take a group of four individuals, one Christian, one Jew, and two Muslims, and travel in Israel and the Palestinian territories, visit with people, see if we could get the kids together, see what's going on there for ourselves. And most importantly, as I think Mark would like to add, and maybe Bashar, to see what the prospects are for a two-state solution in that troubled area.
And Mark, I'll turn it over to you. What's your perspective on that?
Well, here in Louisville, starting in going back about 5 years, 6 years, Bashar Masri and myself had gotten to know each other a little bit professionally, and we kept seeing each other at these community-wide forums about Middle East peace. And we sort of breached across the divide between our two peoples and started opening up a conversation, opening up a dialogue that, in fact, built a lot of faith and trust between Palestinian Americans and Jewish Americans here in Louisville. We've come to agreement about what we see as the need for peace in the Middle East between Israel and Palestine to form a two-state solution, one that would be viable. We can sit in each other's living rooms and come to complete agreement. It's always that point of curiosity. What is it that keeps the people over there continuously from reaching that same conclusion? So by seeing the facts on the ground, we wanted to see if we could maybe find what you might call some of the fulcrum points around which this conflict might turn. Both seeing the barriers to the solution, but also hopefully seeing some of the pathways that will lead to that effective two-state solution.
Bashar, what did you take away from that?
As an American Palestinian, when I met Mark and got to know Mark, and also I lived in this community for many years now, over 20 years, and I developed a lot of friendship with the Jewish communities here, and I found out how much our communities are not aware of each other. And there is a big barrier, and that barrier is based on misunderstanding and just assumption that most of it is untrue. So I said, before we do anything, we have to build some trust and understanding among each other so we could see that we really both side wants the same thing. At the same time, I have a lot of ties and connection to where I came from. I'm from Nablus, the Palestinian area. So I thought I could help my family and community over there by making the people here understand that they really want the same thing as the rest of the world, or in particular the Jewish American communities. So taking that trip, I want Mark and Terry to see that they are going to meet people who are like me, who wants the same thing. And so they could come back and tell their story and message. At the same time, I want to meet Israelis who, I believe, wants and think the same way we do.
We're talking with Terry Taylor, Bashar Masri, and Mark Isaacs of Louisville, who traveled to the Middle East earlier this year on a fact-finding mission. A lot of us have just a superficial knowledge, you know, what we see on television of what's going on over there, and a lot of us probably think there are clearly drawn lines. This is Muslim versus Jew, Palestinian versus Israeli, but it's never that simple. It's a lot more complicated than that.
One thing that consistently we make the point of is that fundamentally this is not a religious conflict. The lines of the conflict frequently do get drawn around religious themes or issues, but the reality, this is a political conflict. If you look at the overwhelming long history between Muslims and Jews in the Middle East and elsewhere, you'll typically find that they are communities that have lived in relative harmony with each other. In the big span of history, that there is mutual respect between those communities. There certainly are elements within each religion which breed intolerance. But we think really that the religion in that sense is being used as an excuse for the intolerance in solving the political problem that's really at the root of the situation.
And Rick, if I could add something to that too, one of the things that many people in the United States don't seem to realize is that this complicated situation involves not just Jews and Muslims in that area, but also Christians. There are a significant number there. And one of the most powerful experiences for me on the entire trip was a conversation we had with a priest in Nazareth, a Catholic priest in Nazareth, who runs a high school and who won a prize from UNESCO, the United Nations organization, for having taken a group of students, Arabic students, to Auschwitz. And the reason he did that and the reason that he won the prize was that this was to illustrate the point that until we understand the deep hurt that the other side feels, we can't really have a serious dialogue with each other.
Looking back at the conflict and between the Palestinian and the Israeli, and how that conflict started and evolved into 50 years till now, into a very complicated conflict, I think there was a failure on both leadership, on the Israeli side and the Palestinian sides. The Israeli side, when they start coming to the Palestinian areas, and a lot of it was during World War One and World War Two, the Jewish migration to that area, they really were, a lot of them were escaping the persecution that's going on in Europe, but they were not aware of the local inhabitants. And nobody told them there is people there. And the local inhabitant look at a lot of these Jewish immigrants as colonizers because they were coming from Europe. At the same time, the Palestinians were colonized by the British. So they couldn't differentiate. So they looked at them as a second form of colonization. So they did not understand that these people were persecuted and suffering in Europe. At the same time, the people who are coming here, they were in denial that there is an existing inhabitants of the land, that they want the same right and privilege. So it started at the wrong foot. And then both sides were in denial of each other existing and suffering. And it started getting better, but then it gets worse. So this is where the conflict evolved into this mess.
And while that's perhaps the roots of the conflict, the most tragic aspect of where we find ourselves today, really, I'd tend to describe as being really a 7-year-old conflict. You know, we think what we hear from fellow Americans is that, oh, they've been fighting each other over there for thousands of years. Well, that's not the story. The real tragedy that we find ourselves in today has its roots really as a 7-year-old conflict, and in that, what I'm referring to is that when the Oslo peace process unraveled finally in the year 2000, and it gave way to the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising, and that then brought the Israeli response of crossing back into the West Bank, reoccupying the West Bank by force, setting up checkpoints, initiating the separation barrier. Suddenly, you have a situation where, in so many ways, Israelis and Palestinians who, for you know, the past 10, 15 years before 2000, were starting to warm in their relations. They were starting to engage each other individually as human beings. They were starting to do business together that was important business and have personal connections. Basically, from the year 2000, all that's been cut off. And so there is this separation between the two peoples. Kids growing up today on the Palestinian side only know Israelis who are soldiers who come into their communities, take their fathers or older brothers out of bed in the middle of the night, take them away to prison, kill relatives. And on the other side, you know, Israelis only know Palestinians as suicide bombers, the very few, but the ones who infiltrate, who blow up buses, who blow up discotheques, blow up family gatherings on important Jewish holidays. Well, you know, this is how the two peoples know each other And there is no other opportunity for them to encounter each other as human beings. That's the tragedy of where we are today.
And Rick, if I could add to that, one thing I'd like to point out about the trip is that every place we went, we asked people, what do you want us to do when we go home to the United States? I don't recall a single person out of hundreds we talked to saying, go home and fix our problem. But virtually every single person we talked to on all sides in this conflict said, we don't think people in the United States know our stories. Go home and tell our stories. And many of those stories that we encountered while we were there were stories of exceptional heroism in the face of the kind of disastrous violence and problem that Mark was just talking about. And people who, in the face of that, continue to work for peace.
And you've been back for quite a while. This has been February, the trip was, correct? So you've been back a while. What have you done with that information here in Louisville?
I think we've been taking and looking for every opportunity to tell the stories that we encountered since we got back. And there are a number of them that I think really point to the kind of situation that we saw and the heroism of the people that we encountered when we were there. And one of the ones I find most compelling is a story that Mark tells about a Hamas cab driver that gave us a lift when we were in the West Bank.
Essentially, everywhere we were, we ran into a wide range of people, and everywhere we went, we asked them, what do you think are the prospects for peace from the other side? And if you want to really get your fingers on the pulse of any city anywhere, you ask the cab drivers. We're driving in the West Bank city of Nablus in a cab. The driver of the cab is he himself is a member of the Hamas party. He's got his brother is a Hamas politician. And when we as Americans hear the word Hamas, immediately. Think that they're all terrorists. I think one of the things that we learned in a very real way is that they're not all terrorists. They're not all for terrorism. They are looking at political choices that are a lot of the election of Hamas had to do with being voting against the corruption of the Fatah party. But we're asking this cab driver, what do you think the prospects for peace with Israel? And in very animated Arabic, as we're charging up this rough road in Nablus, both hands come off the steering wheel, and he says, "It's impossible! It's impossible!" And unfortunately, Bashar and Omar are translating all this. What do you mean it's impossible? He says, the Israelis, the Jews, they want all the land. They want all of Jerusalem. It's impossible. It's impossible. For someone who's very peace loving, at first I thought all my hopes for peace were immediately dashed when I heard such a negative response. Fortunately, Terry had the presence of mind to ask the question, what do you think? What do you think if there could be a Palestinian state going back to the 1967 borders, a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem, an Israeli state, capital in West Jerusalem? Do you think you could live with Israel under such a situation? So here's this guy representing what we as Americans think of as being the most extreme political party in the Middle East, certainly in Palestine. And his immediate response was, we've got to give it a try. We've got to try it. And on the Israeli side, we sort of had the equivalent experience. We had dinner one evening in the home of some folks that you would probably have to classify as being settlers. They're not the most ideological of the Jewish settlers, but they are religiously very observant, and they're living in what at least you would call a greater Jerusalem settlement town. When I say the words Greater Jerusalem, what I'm talking about is an Israeli vision, which basically is surrounding historic Jerusalem with Israeli settlements that are going far into the West Bank. These are a real thorn in the side of the Palestinians. But because it's around Jerusalem, and because at this point it's built up as a full city, we went by cinemas and cafes and traffic circles and big built-up city, tens of thousands of people, this is probably likely to stay under Israeli hands in a final solution. So we're with this religious family, and we asked them, what are the prospects for peace? And after going through animated stories about drawing from the Talmud about how one approaches negotiations and compromise, and after being taught a lesson about that, even this very ardent, religiously right Jewish settler had to say, for a real peace, we would make a compromise. So we got that from all sides and from all the spectrum in between. I think though what is at that very table though, there was a one of the young sons, 9, 10 years old, and Terry asked him what he thought the prospects for peace were in his lifetime. And he screwed up his face, kind of, and he thought about it very thoughtfully, very deeply. And he told us, you know, this is the only thing I've ever known. And that really expresses the tragedy of the current situation. There is a desire for peace on both sides, and yet a whole generation that's growing up without any sense that it's really possible.
Is it possible? Do you hold out hope that the people in charge can work out something?
You could always hope, but the reality on the ground does not support the hope. But what hopeful is people, a lot of people we met still hopeful. And I think a lot of condition on the ground has to change before we really think this peace is possible and it's going to happen. And I think on the Palestinian side, one situation we have, you don't have two equal party. You don't have two equal government. You have the Palestinian, really their government is very weak and does not represent their aspiration. I mean, what kind of government is when a prime minister cannot be able to travel in his own home? That's not a government. What kind of government when he needs to get a permission from the Israeli to fly in his airplane? So that's, you're not talking about two equal countries, okay? So that's very important to understand. At the same time, on the Palestinian side, their areas is separated. It's not connected together. There is no free movement of people, no free movement of goods. They're not control their water. They don't control their electricity. They don't control their crossing. So a lot of things on the ground has to change. I think as much of the wall the Israeli think brought them security as, and I think it's a false sense of security. It's a temporary security, and a lot of the Palestinian thinks. And actually, a lot of the wall is built on their area. They say the Green Line is 290 miles long. The proposed wall is 720 miles long. So it's for them, it's going to grab their area and territory. So all of this has to change for the Palestinian to have a sense of community and a sense of peace themselves. And I think that itself will give the security to Israel. And we always said, you have to have a country or a Palestinian state to have a secure Israel. and both sides has to work with each other or both sides will not have their securities.
We're speaking with Louisvillians Mark Isaacs, Terry Taylor, and Bashar Masri, who are recounting their experiences while in the Middle East earlier this year. And one final question. Any plans to go back in the near future?
I think what we've opened up in through our February trip is an understanding that there is this crying need to find ways to bring the people together, even in the midst of the current separation. And as opposed to just doing projects that might bring 25 Israeli and Palestinians together, how do we do projects that begin to bring hundreds, thousands of and especially focusing on the youth, of kids together on both sides to encounter each other, to learn about each other? So we've come back asking ourselves a lot of questions about how do we do work on projects over there that are sustainable and scalable. And speaking for myself, at least, I think all three of us are beginning to ask ourselves this question: is then how do we begin to block out a month at a time out of our schedules that allow us to travel back and hopefully travel back soon? We're still fighting for those answers, but fighting for the kind of solutions and projects that can be part of the solution over there.
Well, as always, we'll be watching with interest from our point of view here. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
More information is available at our website. Go to WFPL.org. When we come back, we'll see what it's like to captain a moving historic landmark that graces the Ohio River in Louisville. It's part of our new series, A Day in the Life. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Julie Goodwin. WFPL begins a new series today called A Day in the Life, in which we spend a day with Louisvillians and their working environments. Our first expedition is aboard a moving history lesson, a 92-year-old lady known as the Belle of Louisville. WFPL's Stephanie Sanders spent a recent weekday morning with Captain Mark Doty, who is checking the log to see what the day will bring.
Well, we do have Anthony from high school this morning. We board at 9 o'clock. And then we cruise from 9:30 to, it's like 12:30. And we'll have our break time in between. And we won't actually load again until 6:30 in the evening. So then we cruise from 7 to 10. But I'm going to go down and get a cup of coffee because I haven't woke up yet.
Coffee is a big part of the story of the captain's day. He's back on the Belle at 8 a.m. after a midnight cruise that ended at 2 a.m. This is the first of many, many coffee breaks throughout the day.
It's been easy to be clean for a while. We're all drunk this morning.
The captain downplays his role in the preparation of the vessel, but after the students for the first trip have boarded, he joins the pilot in the pilot house, a small room that houses the steering controls and the foot pedal to the giant whistle.
Back and slow. He can't see what's going on, so I'm his eyes out here.
Watch here.
During takeoff, Captain Doty stands on a small platform that juts out from the top level of the ship off the starboard bow. That's front and right to all you land dwellers out there.
Okay, Captain, I'll stop you. Let it go.
Roger.
Let go.
It's all gone, Cap. It's all yours.
Back and slow. Shut
up. Back and slow.
From here, the captain makes his way back to the pilot house, completes some paperwork for the voyage, and kicks back while the pilot guides the Belle along her 3-hour cruise at the Ohio River. During that 3 hours, the captain may do nothing. He might pilot the steamer for a while to give his crewmate a break. He may walk around the vessel while she's underway. Mostly he stays in the pilot house. That's the central area of communication during the cruise. It's where crew members come for their breaks or to make the captain aware of problems on the ship. From there, Captain Doty can assign tasks, keep an eye on the progress of the cruise, or just shoot the breeze.
They're drawing the dance floor. Only the lovebirds are out here.
Easy cleanup on the Texas tonight, won't it?
Oh, yeah. The teachers are up there.
The same processes of boarding, taking off, and cruising will be repeated in another 8 hours or so, but with a different pilot and a different set of passengers. The most challenging part of Captain Doty's day is landing the boat.
And we only sit five and a half, about 5 feet in the water, 58 feet out of the water. We have no bow thruster, like I said, just got the paddle wheel. So when you stop your engine coming in here for a landing, you turn it into a styrofoam cup floating on the river. And you're at the mercy of the wind and the current. So the way we train is that when we're coming in for our landing, and we're still 10 minutes away, you better have already planned where you want to be 5 minutes from now, because you might not be if you don't plan ahead.
Think of it this way. It's like parallel parking a tractor trailer that's more than twice the length of a regular rig, and it's on ice, and without using reverse. And the rig also happens to be a National Historic Landmark with about 500 people on board. So you can see why there's a lot more conversation surrounding the boat's upcoming landing.
Mark, I reckon I'll just keep on that bridge here.
Yeah.
Until we get up. I'll just let her run slow ahead and go. You can help me otherwise.
All right.
Then we're back out on the platform where the captain can guide the crew through a successful landing. From a comm system mounted to the platform, he can talk with the pilot and the engineers in the boiler room on the lowest level of the ship. And a simple lean over the platform puts him right above the deckhands, who are stationed at the bow of the ship, ready to toss out check lines to the wharf boat.
As soon as we get below the wharf boat there, we'll go ahead and give her some right rudder and punch her head a couple, just a lick or two.
Yeah, all right, got you, fine. Tell me when we're below it.
Roger. We're about even with it now. Go ahead and give her some right rudder and go ahead and punch her head a couple licks.
Coming ahead, a couple licks, dead slow.
Roger.
Forward or right rudder.
This goes on for about 10 minutes. The party continues in the ship's ballroom. Activity continues along the waterfront and interstate traffic buzzes overhead. But the captain and his crew are focused on guiding this steamboat into its home between the wharf boat and its sister ship, the Spirit of Jefferson. Hearing the captain describe the landing impresses upon a visitor how much skill is required to operate one of Louisville's most famous landmarks.
Well,
there we go.
We're touching. All right, let's go ahead and switch your line over. See how we had to play that? Way wide with the wind. The wind doesn't work for us. Well,
the story of Captain Doty's day involves coffee, long hours, and idle minutes in the pilot house. But it also has a lot to do with years of dedication to his trade and a love of the water.
What I'd like to do at an early retirement age is have a charter fishing boat off the coast of Florida somewhere where it's warm every year, year round. That'd be an ideal thing to do, but outside of going somewhere else, working assembly line somewhere, this is it.
For pictures of Captain Mark Doty's day and links to information about the Belle of Louisville, visit our website, wfpl.org. For WFPL, I'm Stephanie Sanders.
That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about today's show, go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts and our audio archive. You can also write us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, including WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Julie Goodwin. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.